begin? Yeah. Okay, today is a very important day. Yesterday was Yom Yerushalayim. Today may be even more important. I'll call it Yom HaShagrirut, the embassy day. And I'll explain later why today may be more important. Today is May 14th, 2018. And I say Boker Tov, hello, Chag Sameach to all those in front of me and to the many listening across the world who don't even realize what a great Chag we have today. A few items just catching up. Judge Rosalsky, who we spoke about last week, indeed has an entry in the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, Volume 9, pages 199 to 200. But it's not online. There are snippets of the encyclopedia online, but what you said is correct. You have to buy in if you want to get it all. You also want to mention a very interesting article by someone who you perhaps all know, Professor Ephraim Konefogel. So he writes about the Rav from a different aspect. The Rav's interest or ability in scientific Jewish scholarship. I've spoken on this over the decades. The history of the Tosfot and the literary corpus, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik's interpretations of the Keynote for Tisha B'Av, he takes the Keynote and he takes all the historical material that the Rav said over the years in Boston, and he shows that the Rav had a good feel for the history of the Rishonim. In other words, Chaim Soloveitchik didn't just grow up on in a desert. It's even before he met Professor Katz, his father had feeling. It's an interesting topic. I know that my last discussion with the Rav, face to face, eye to eye, was in his apartment in 1983. I went to see him. I went to the shir, and then I walked back to his apartment. I walked back, they were mechabed me to walk on his right side and help carry him. I didn't realize how bad his condition was, but his mind was quite clear. And we spoke about Chochmat Yisrael. Listen, Shaftan, I bothered Rebbe about his uncle, Rabbi Menachem Karakovsky, in Avodat HaMelech, quotes the Rav, if you recall the conversation. I said to Rebbe, I found four places where your uncle quotes you. And he said, no, six. And then when I got back, I grabbed the guy in the Kollel, who's a real a character par excellence, a Ramaz graduate, by the way, Kloisner. You all know him, Yedidja, Harab Yedidja today, Harab Yosef Tzvi Kloisner. And I said, Klaus, you got a job to do for me. How many times does the Rabbi Menachem quote his uncle, Moreinu V'Rabbeinu? He came up with eight, and I think in my book, I have all eight in a footnote. But that the Rav knew what Chochmat Yisrael was, there's no question. That he wasn't attracted to it scholarly is also, I don't think we can debate it. I think it's a fact. His thrust was brisk. And brisk and Chochmat Yisrael are two different worlds. It could be that Tells and even Reb Shimon Shkup, and I don't want to go into more detail, I can explain what I'm trying to say, but it would take a few hours, could be they were even a little bit closer to Chochmat Yisrael. Because they dealt with social, non-halachic matters that affected the halacha. Brisk is klo halacha, nothing else. Anyway, a very interesting article, and I call your attention to it. Another article of interest, and I thank my dear Talmud Aryeh Liebman, who may be one of my greatest finds. He came up with a whole article on Maria. I couldn't believe it. There's a book that came out on Belgian Jewry, and one of the chapters is on Kehilat Moria. And he evidently had the Chabad library order that chapter from Brandeis. In other words, one university helps another. And he sent me a copy of the chapter. I know the person who wrote the chapter. It's years ago. We're talking 30, 40 years. It's not yesterday. But the person who wrote the chapter is Judith Baumel. I don't know what name she goes by today, Judith Tidor Bamel, T-Y-D-O-R. If you recognize the name Bamel, it's a very sad name. That's the family. Her brother-in-law is missing in action since 1982, which again is the topic that I've been very heavily involved with. That's the name Bamel. Excuse me? Zach Bamel, son of Yonah and Miriam. The tragedy, I mean, to me, tragedy today, it's all over the place. She's divorced. She's not a Bamel anymore. She was married to Zach's brother, an older brother. And she has a beautiful article, and I could spend the rest of the hours, 2 hours, talking about Maria. But what's interesting is she differs with Rabbi Joseph Karasik's memoir. What I spoke about last week, remember I put into the record how Maria began, he has it beginning in 1938. She has it beginning in 1943. So I don't know, in other words, how can you have a 5-year difference? This is not a year or two it began, it didn't begin officially. She claims it began in the middle of the war. Rabbi Breut, as I said last week, was a gone idea. And that's why they wanted someone like the Rav to take over. And I was absolutely right. The Rav was succeeded in the rabbinate by Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. Rabbi Aaron was succeeded by Rabbi Yosef Weiss. Why did Maria disappear? I mean, these were not poor Jews. They could have established another congregation. They could have gotten out of the second floor. It was Broadway and 80th, which I mean, I remember it like yesterday. There was a music school, a dancing school. You could hear, when you walked in, you could hear music. Kids were practicing. All right, they could have gone elsewhere. But it was exactly what I said last week. Baruch Shekivanti, because I didn't do my research in the field, but my theory was correct. Look, the first generation, you came from Belgium, Landsmanschaft. It's like when my book on the Rav came out, when my book, my scholarly memoir from Washington Avenue to Washington Street came out, we had a book launch at Heichal Shlomo. Heichal, am I right? The Great Synagogue, I don't remember. Maybe it's the Great Synagogue, not Heichal Shlomo, it was the Great Synagogue. So we had a book launch. And who spoke? I mean, what a night. Tova Lichtenstein, Yosef Hatzadik Mendelovich, and your humble servant, the author of the book. Oh, so you might think, what speakers? And all that everyone was talking about later was the Bronx. All right? It was the Bronx. We grew up in the Bronx. I remember Toby Willicks that say, is it Chronit Tzadeket Levracha? They were dancing kazatskis that someone wrote about the Bronx. Yeah, but the new generation doesn't have that feeling. The new generation didn't need a Belgium-oriented Machzikei Hadat congregation. This, the boy wonder, just what I said last week, she says it in scholarship. Stevie Wonder, Rabbi Rishkin is doing miracles down the block. These kids are Americanized. Doib Tzedek is being resuscitated. These kids are Americanized. It's like Israel today. You're Ashkenazi. This one is Sephardi. I look at my grandchildren. I look at their wives. I look at... They're not Ashkenazim. They're not Sephardim. They're Israelis. It's a big difference. They're totally integrated. And my great-grandchildren already... Many of them won't even know what it means to... You're a Mizrahi. You know what I'm saying? It's like they put you down. You're a... Doesn't exist today. You know, if Obama can be president of the United States, and you all know what the history, lynching and blacks and what went on 100 years ago and 90 years ago and 80 years ago, so Ribbono Shel Olam, here it's an ingathering of exiles. No one came on the Mayflower. And those who came on the Mayflower, there's barely anyone left. Very simply, why? They became irreligious. No, once you give up Shabbos and Kashrut, the next generation, what do I need Israel for? He takes off, disappears, go to Los Angeles, go to Miami, you'll hear, go to Cape Town, go to Melbourne, you'll hear Hebrew on every street corner. Okay. Anyway, very, very interesting. Finally, would you believe it? Remember I told you that I always feel bad when I speak on Shabbos because it's not recorded. And now I see what it means, the recordings. I see the correspondence that comes in from all over the world, the shirm being given in Gris Kollel. And sometimes some Shabbos I'm good. You know, during the week, no, it's chol, chulin. But Shabbos, I gave two drushes on the Rav when I was in America now for YU. They were on the Rav's level. The Rav taught me how to speak. The Rav taught me how to put a medrash together, how to put a machshava. No, I gave it on Shabbos. All right, people enjoyed it. By the time they ate Sudah Shlishit, they forgot what I said. You understand? So remember I told you once in Los Angeles, they wanted to bring in a guy to record me. What Satmar did here with the Russian Goyim in Meron a year ago. Remember or not, the Rebbe was here, and on Shabbos, the Russian guy videoed. So I told him, absolutely not. Do you know that here, Sholom Meshiv, the Rav HaRashi Leretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, the exact question, are you allowed to record the Rebbe's talk on Shabbos? You'll have it set up, you'll have a time clock, you'll have a Russian guy come in, and he asks, he's speaking no different than yours truly. Okay. Finally, catching up, I have a lot to do, and we got a roll, and I have interesting material. But what are we talking about now? Michael, we're in the middle of the history of Torah in the United States. The Rebbe has been driving people crazy on this topic. This may be the seventh year. And I think we need another 7 years to bring it to conclusion. I want to reach 1960. So we're dealing here with the kashrut problems, which was the greatest problem on the scene. Of course, you can't have Yiddishkeit without the ability to eat. The most important part is a mikveh. You have to have a mikveh. That's the first thing a community... The shul is the last thing a community has to build. You have to be aware of it. You need a mikveh. You need the ability to have kosher food. All right, davening, you can daven in here in Yerushalayim. People daven on the streets. You see minyanim all over the place. All right, in America, maybe you don't want to daven on the street, but you can daven in the house. You don't need a shul. It's the last thing. Now, to help the skelter, the question of gelatin. So one of our Talmidim listening sent me a tshuva that his mother got when she questioned whether Jell-O is kosher. And I don't know if you recall, they don't eat kogel. Jell-O itself had a heksha, J-E-L-L-O, had a K on it. And that K, these are two rabbanim whom I knew, Rabbi Yehuda Gershuni and Rabbi David Telzner, gave the heksha. And they sent her, she wrote to Rabbi Telzner. Rabbi Telzner lived in Yerushalayim for many years. So he's American. I knew him from the States, then I knew him from Yerushalayim. His son is one of the famous Chabad Rabbanim in Australia today. His son married the daughter of Rabbi Itcher David Groner, who brought Chabad, who brought Yiddishkeit to Australia. So they wrote to Rabbi Telzner, is it kosher, isn't it kosher? And he writes back exactly what we're talking about. Rabbi Chaim Isaac Grzynski of Vilna, blessed memory, and he gives the source from the Achiezer, when by chemical processes the elements are separated and a new substance is produced, since it cannot be attained unless the original material it is dried and spoiled, in halachic language, lavroi lachilat kelev, even if later by chemical processes it is given a good taste, it is considered a new substance.
Didn't the Rav say something about
it? Yeah, we spoke about it. The Rav held that it was mutter. The Rav held like Reb Chaim Isaac Rishi. And this was the whole machleiket that we spoke in the Sunday class. Remember in detail. All right. Adkan, I just wanted to bring myself up to date because we're coming to Shavuot. We're going to have a break of a week, and at this moment, I am up to date. All right. So we spoke about the big machlokes in America, the kashrut, what went on, and how it comes to New York, and the plumber and Rabbi Barashansky, and we could never get organized in the United States. It's freedom, it's democracy. We owe the greatest vote of thanks to the OU. They brought communal responsibility. They gave birth after post-World War II. Kashrut today is an entirely different story. and basically you don't have scandals. Unfortunately, scandals crop up, and what's even worse is that they crop up from Jews taking treif chickens and substituting them and making believe they're kosher, which is beyond comprehension. But you have to be very careful, and in order to give heksha, it's not just halacha you have to know, but you have to have a wise mind, street sense. You have to be a shtickle, a detective, a member of the Mossad, we'll put it that way. And you see this Rebbe in Muncie who is giving hashkacha, and then this guy in the middle of the night substituting chickens, he never will give hashkacha again. He was so offended. I mean, do you have confidence? Do you trust someone? He's a frum Jew. He learns the daf yomi. He layens. He davens from Ahmed. And take a look what the man was capable of doing. And, excuse me?
I don't think
there's true. Say that we spoke about it. Okay. But I want to move on. And now I want to move on to the most dominant figure that the Agudas HaRabbanim produced. And when you talk about Reb Lazer Silva, you're talking about the entire era. I'll begin ultimately. I have more to say. I want to talk about his life. I want to talk about the personality. But we'll talk about Kashrut, and from Kashrut we'll go on to his other great achievements.
Didn't you already
do this? No. I never thought what I'm going to do now. I mentioned his name for 2 minutes. Now we're going in detail.
Well, you went into detail when it was
bad. Take my word for it. Reb Lazer, I want to bring you a proof to something I said a few weeks ago. Reb Lazer Silva, first of all, his years 1881-1968. And he came from a Litvisha family. Remember I told you why he ran to America? He, thanks to the story, he was the son of the Dushtada Rav, which he was the grandson of the Dushtada Rav, generations. And he had a Goynisha cup. He never really went to a yeshiva. He studied privately with Rabbanim. He went to Dvinsk had two great Rabbanim sitting in a little shtetl. One was the Litvisha Rav, was the Ar Sameach, Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen, the Ar Sameach, you all know the name. The other one was the Hasidish Rav, Rav Yosef Rosen, the Ragat Shabagon. And it was amazing, one little city. He studied with both of them. Then afterwards, he studied with Reb Chaim Eiser in Reb Chaim Eiser's kibbutz, it was called. It's a term we'll talk about in the future. Reb Chaim Eiser had some very brilliant students gathered around him and studied with him, and Reb Chaim Eiser raised the funds to support them, among them with Shlomo Palachek, the Maitre Te'iloi. But Reb Lazer Silva spent a few years with him, and then his father insisted he go to Brisk to study with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik to see what's happening. Everyone talks about Brisk, new Matan Torah. And then he walked into the Strassun library, and as I told you, he saw the librarian and Malka Abramowitz, I believe was her maiden name, and Basia Aronovitz, his mother's name was Malka, Basia Aronovitz, and they married in 1906. He came to America in 1907. He had 4 children with her. Yes?
My mother's family is from Dvinsk, and their maiden name was Aronovitz.
Aronovitz, that's the name here. Yeah. Checkmate, you may be related. Basia Aronovitz. They had 4 children. Children are very interesting. His eldest child, born in 1907, was David Harav David Leib Silva. David L. Silva, was an unbelievable individual. He didn't succeed his father in Harrisburg, but years later took Harrisburg, and everyone figured it would be his first shtela. Harrisburg was a small city, and in Harrisburg he remained the rest of his life, well into his 90s. Reb Lezer Sula was a volcano, shot into space very easily, yelled, shouted. Reb David was the calmest, nicest, sweetest person in the world. There was a daughter born a few years later, Yetta. She married Dr. Louis Eisenstein. They lived in Springfield, Massachusetts. He was a medical doctor, Shemesh Shabbos. His yichus, he was in Yeshiva College's first graduating class. Can anyone tell me what year the first class graduated? Remember what I told you last week or in the past? Yeshiva College opened its doors. It opened its doors in 28. I began my talk in Jewish Center a few weeks ago that you should put up a plaque that Yeshiva College began in this building that's celebrating 100 years, 90 years ago, September 1928. The reason they had to begin there and not uptown, the campus wasn't ready yet. The campus is first dedicated Chanukah Tabayit Chanukah, and January, basically, of 1929, Yeshiva College moves uptown. So he was in the first graduating class. Anyone know some other people? Rabbi Lewittis. Remember Emmanuel, remember the famous Rabbi Lewittis?
Montreal.
He was in the first graduating class. Then came twins, Bessie and Nathan. Bessie marries, whose name did we just mention a minute ago? Reb Yehuda Gershuni, do any of you knew Reb Yehuda Gershuni? Who was he? He was an Eloi, a Gaon, but he was a Mizrachiite. So in the Europeische Yeshiva, they recognized him. He was a Gaon, but he never got that far. He came to America, and Etzich Gemutschet, he never really found his total place on the American scene. Later, he lives in Israel. He has a daughter living here, who is very famous. She's a lawyer, a very competent lawyer, very brilliant. She has a number of children living here, but this daughter, she was the one who worked out the laws with the Knesset to stop the people would bring women here and trade them and use them in prostitution, Aleinu. Today, that has almost been totally eliminated. Israel has done so much in that field that they won a special prize from the American State Department, I think it was. It was because of her work for the Misrat HaMishpatim. She's an anagle of Reb Lezer Sula Gershuni. The other twin was Nathan, who became a cardiologist and lived in Cincinnati. So you see, the family is integrated not just on the American scene, on the Yeshiva University scene. Do not forget this, because you'll see next year it plays a role in Reb Lezer Sula, his relationship with Agudat HaRabbanim, his relationship with RCA, his relationship with Agudat Yisrael, and his relationship with the Mizrahi. He was not an individual who was narrow-minded. He saw the much greater picture. Now, he comes to America in 1907. The first thing he does, he wants to enter his family's business. He has cousins here. He doesn't want to be a Rav. Wants to be independent. Spends a few months working in the garment industry, 7th Avenue, all in the hands of Jews, then insurance salesman, and by the latter part of the year, they tell him, Lezer, the only field that you can succeed in is to be a Rav. And that's how he winds up in Pittsburgh. And now I want to show you in more detail what I alluded to. And it's very important to understand him. If you recall, I said very quickly in passing, he was an American-made gadol. What do I mean by that? Anyone else who came to America came a finished product. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik told the Rav, I heard this from Rebbe with my own ears, my tata at me gezak, about the Rabbanim in America as they cook in ice. V'chashev Rabbanim. They look so chashev. But about all they have are good memories. Aguta Zikaron. So the Rav looked at his father. What do you mean? He says, believe me. He says to his son, Gleib Mir, from the Tzaytzeim undercover, from the time they came to America, they never opened the Gemara again. They never learned again. All they have are the memories of Europe. And there's a lot of truth to that. They were caught up in America, caught up with all the problems, all the heartache, all the greats, the achievements of the rabbinate, and all the aggravations and the disgrace of the rabbinate. Reb Lezer Silva was very different. He went to Harrisburg, and he had a Goynisha cup, but he hadn't learned that much. He was a youngster yet. In Harrisburg, he sat and learned from the minute he finished his full responsibilities, 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. He sat in the shul till 12 o'clock at night, 1 o'clock in the morning. His wife brought him food, and he became a self-made gong. He mastered American thought, American civilization. Okay, now, you'll say to me, Rebbe, don't overstate the case, as Gevena Gringa. All right, he could preach in English. He spoke English. He was not that comfortable. When he got emotional, I saw with my own eyes, he broke into Yiddish. But his English was good. His English was fine. But, yes, he was a Yiddish speaker. His formative years were in Europe, but he understood the American scene. And here I'm going to quote to you from a very rare volume. It's called Silver Linings. Silver Linings. It was put out by the shul in Harrisburg in 1997 when its rabbi, Rabbi David Silver, celebrated his 90th birthday. And I'm quoting to you from page 8. It's a very fascinating little volume. It's a memoir of Reb David Silver. And here he's talking about, he's a first grade kid in school. So what are we talking about, 1911, 1912? An interesting thing happened to me in first grade. During the Christmas period, the children were taught and used to sing, of course, Christmas carols. Jewish children were supposed to be excused. But I can still remember the teacher watching me and seeing that I was not joining in. So she took a strap and hit me across my feet. In those days, you didn't wear long trousers. You wore knickers. And I can still remember her hitting me with the strap. It didn't hurt. But I came home for lunch and I told my father what had happened in school. My father said, quote, nothing doing. If it goes on in one school, it could go on in another school. So my father called the superintendent of schools, an outstanding liberal and educated person. He said to my father, Rabbi, I'll investigate the case. He checked and he found out that the teachers were forcing Jewish children to sing carols. He had called the principal of the school to check into it, and she reported that, unfortunately, it was true. So the superintendent called my father and said, Rabbi Silver, what your child told you is true. We are ready to fire the teacher if that is what you think should be done. My father replied, quote, no, I don't want you to fire one teacher. Just give an order to all your teachers to leave the Jewish children alone. They're not supposed to engage in that. And some may be tempted to join in because they're afraid of the teachers. That's all I ask of you. And the superintendent said, Rabbi, your wish shall be done. Now, what does that little anecdote tell you? Reb Lezer Silver understands the American scene. He's Americanized. He didn't yell, he didn't shout, didn't want the world to cave in. If you have a decent Gentile, work out an accommodation. It's a little story. But that story repeats itself time and again in Reb Blaze's life saga. Okay. Now a step further and come to maybe the most famous moment of his life. And if anyone here has the ability to do a movie, I'm giving you the plot and you don't owe me anything. I throw out topics for PhDs and whatnot. Everyone has a good laugh at the Rebbe. But nevertheless, I was just in my office. I threw out two PhD topics. Everyone laughs, but all right. I got a lot of PhDs sitting here. It's okay. Charlie, he is Rav. He's in Harrisburg. His parents are alive. You go back every number of months to see your mother, to see your sisters, your brother. Right or wrong? He wanted to see his parents. He's now made a little money. Believe it or not, the year he goes back is 1914. Visits his father, his mother, sees what's going on in Europe, and while he's in Europe, World War I breaks out. Knew who else did this happen to? Rav Cook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Remember, they were calling for a nascent organizational meeting, a precursor to what would happen to form Agudat Yisrael. And Rav Cook traveled to Europe. It wasn't like today. You get on a plane and three and a half hours later, you're in the heart of Russia. Rav Cook traveled to Europe and walked. World War I broke out. He was stranded. That's how he goes to Switzerland. Switzerland to England. And he finally comes back in 1919 as the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. So he's stranded and everyone is frightened because Rav Blazer Silver was born in Russia, had Russian citizenship. You're dealing with the Tsarist government. The grounds are a battlefield. And he has a wife and children in Harrisburg. How do you contact them? How do you reach them? How do you let them know you are alive? And at the Taugeblatt, the New York Daily newspaper, which was a Shomer Shabbos paper, later it morphs into the Morgenjournal, they get a postcard. A very, very strange postcard. And it's from Rav Blaze Silver to the Taugeblatt. He knew the address by heart. Lower East Side. And they're worried stiff, he's lost his mind. No one can understand what he wrote. It's like a movie. It was a very famous story at the time. Even when I was growing up, I remember hearing fragments of it. So they took the postcard to Reb Shalom Yaffe, one of the famous Rabbanim. He was the masmich of Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. Remember, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein always had an inferiority complex when people said he's a JTS graduate. And the response always was, and I also have a private smicha for Rabbi Shalom Yaffe. I say, no one could put that down. And who else did they take it to? To Rabbi Israel Rosenberg. And they looked at the postcard and figured out what the postcard was about. Now, I actually saw the postcard, and I'll give you two sources, and you can compare what was written. This is also a real little volume. Ish ha-halakha v'ha-ma'aseh ha-gon ha-adir avir ha-roim Rabbi Eliezer Silva Shlita Nasiya ha-rabbanim bi-atzot ha-brit ha-rav ha-roshi le'ir rabati Cincinnati, Ohio. This was published in 1947. Who did the biography? All right. Harav Menachem Glickman. Anyone know who Harav Menachem Glickman was, is? Who are we talking about? Harav Menachem Parish. The original Glick name of the family was Glickman. It was Hebratized to Parish. You all know his son, his grandson, its endless politicians, his father. I knew Rav Menachem Parish very well. As a matter of fact, he offered me a job. Had I accepted, I wouldn't be sitting here, and I would have been a much wealthier man and had food for the fourth Shabbos of the month. I wouldn't have had to go to Machon Gold. The taxes were unbelievable, and I was white, and all the money was black. How could you understand? It was a different Israel. Let me tell you, we have to bench the Likud every day for what they accomplished here. Charlie, you're here almost as long as I am. You know what I'm talking about. I bench Rami Levy every day for what he's done for us poor Jews, that we can live here in dignity. And Netanyahu, I never saw. He's making the Yankees look bad, and he's doing fabulous. Netanyahu's doing even better right now. Wow, what a streak of good fortune. We'll talk about it later. Okay, anyway, so Rav Menachem Parish wanted me to be his rosh. He met me in 69, and he offered me the position of running his office, to be the rosh lash, the rosh lishkato. He's not a dummy. So I imagine that this book was written because he was getting money for a blaze of silver. I go to Yisrael, his orphanage, his projects. So he wrote a book giving Rav Lezer Silva unbelievable covet. If you go to page 29, he tells the story that of the postcard, that everyone was worried stiff, and he didn't know what to do, and all the mail is being censored going out of Russia. I still remember in Russia, under the communists, there were two different mailboxes, a red one and a blue one. So I asked my contacts there, what's the difference? He said, well, one is for local and one is outside of the city. But he says, it doesn't matter. All the letters go to the censorship. And I have news for you. I hope I'm not revealing secrets, but the security clause was lifted on me. All the letters coming in from Russia, the Mossad read them first. Our unit. One time I walk in to meet with the boss, and he throws at me a letter. It was a Xerox copy, and they open it, they reseal it. You can never tell it was read. He says, "Tira, Eisha Chaverim Yeshlecha." You know, it was a letter dealing with how you beat the taxes in Israel, explaining to people there, don't worry, it's no different than the way we lived in Russia. A lot is under the table, and the boss was livid with rage. So here, Maskin Ishkachat. So here, he's worried stiff, so he sends a postcard quoting a Tosfos in Megillah where the word Germania, which he uses to refer to Germany, is mentioned. He quotes a Tosfos in Masechet Moed Katan where the word Russia is mentioned. He quotes psukim that talk about swords, cherev, swords, tahar, tamei. He quotes the Chafetz Chaim's letter, Shmirat HaLashon, and all these quotes, and the Rabbanim figured out that he's not crazy, he hasn't lost his mind, he is avoiding censorship. And I'll quote to you from Rakefet, the Suvi era, page 59, about this visit, that first of all, he visits his aged parents. And immediately, everyone wants to see what became of their son in America, the Golden of Medina. And while he's there, a wounded soldier came back from the battlefront, and the son of Zalman the butcher, and the wounded soldier said testimony that the son of Zalman the butcher was killed in the same battle. I need not tell you, this is, those of you familiar with the lower lane of what goes on here, I see, I was in the army, my sons-in-law were in the army, my grandchildren, but my grandson who was injured, the psychological scars that you come out of it alive, but this one didn't come back, that one didn't come back, and no, can you be certain? So Zalman hears his son was killed. He comes to ask Reblaise Suva's father, should he sit shiva for his son? And Reblaise's father consults with his son, and his son tells him, no, you shouldn't sit shiva. Reblaise quotes the Gemara in Yevamah. I believe it's Daf Kuf Zayin in Rakafar Aaron Chelik Gimel. I deal with the Gemara in depth. It's called Bididami. That's the rubric of that Gemara. You know what Bididami means? You imagine a battlefield. Have you ever been on a battlefield? I was on the battlefields twice, but in 82, I was mamish way, way up front. And you don't know what's going on in there. It's helter-skelter. The noise is overwhelming. Helicopters flying, planes over there, tanks over here, artillery over here, field hospital over here, water, food. It's helter-skelter. And Bididami, sometimes you can't be sure, you can't be certain, you're confused. So Reblaise told his father, don't paskin, they should sit shiva, wait until the war is over. And 2 years later, the kid comes back alive and well, surviving all the battles. And Reblaise, ultimately, that turned him in like to a hero. Everyone spoke about it. But with the postcard, during this period, I'm quoting from page 61, the Sula era, it was in the form of a postcard addressed to the New York Orthodox Daily Yiddishe Tageblatt. The contents of the communication discussed the unavailability of certain volumes. Silva requested that the recipients inform the yeshiva head and students in Harrisburg and the judges of the Agudas Harabonim of his lack of success. Silva claimed that the three missing books were titled The Proper Path, At the Crossroads, The Illuminated Way. He also made intricate references to appropriate Talmudic comments, topics and commentaries. He referred to the prohibition against crossing the Tchum, the boundary beyond which one must not walk on the Sabbath. He also cited Milchamot Hashem of the Ramban of Nachmanides. Silva indicated that he could not be more precise because of the need to guard one's tongue, as indicated in the Shmirat HaLashon of the Chafetz Chaim. He also stated, all the gates are locked except the gates of tears. That's a Maimon Chazal. You understand? The man was brilliant.
How did he get this all on one postcard?
I saw the postcard. It's little scribblings, just what I quoted here is all on one postcard. He didn't elaborate. He left it for the person who would read it, so the Rabbanim got all excited. He's alive. So they told the family in Harrisburg nothing to worry about. He can't get out, but he's alive. Now, while he was in Europe, I want to refer you to something else that it's also an unbelievable little story, how he visits two of the great Rabbonim in Dvinsk, which he was able to get to, and he visits the Rakatshava and he visits Reb Meir Simcha. So he goes into the Rakatshava, and the Ragged Shover is in the middle of eating, and his wife says to Reblaise, maybe you won't disturb the Rav, let him finish eating, but the Ragged Shover hears he's there, he jumps up, no, I have to speak, I have to talk and learning, and then he says to Reblaise, this was his second wife, right? His first wife had died, he remarried, He said, "Ach, do I suffer with my second wife? My first wife didn't care if I ate or didn't date. She would constantly let me talk and learning whenever I want. And my second wife worries about, won't let me talk and learning and insist that I eat and be healthy. Oy vey, was is mir getroffen, you follow?" This is a good Rabbanish joke with the rocket shove. With Reb Leizer, with Reb Meir Simcha, something happened which again repeats itself, and I'm so happy. Baruch Shekivanti Ledat Gedolim. I'll explain myself in a second. But something happened very fascinating. If you recall, the biggest machlokes of kashrut in America in the early 1900s, right after RJJ, was the machlokes with the Ritbaz in Chicago. Who was the Baal Plukta with him? Rabbi Shimon Tzvi Album, Rabbi Album. So he goes into Reb Meir Simcha, you know, they're happy, my Talmud, and tell me about America. And then Reb Meir Simcha says, "What happened to Harav Album? He was my chavrut in my youth, he was a gon. He could have been the greatest gon had he stayed in Europe." And he says, and you know, Reb Leizer told him, machlokes, this, that, and garnished, mcgarnished. So Reb Meir Simcha says, "Ich verstehe nicht eure Amerika. I don't understand America. It takes great people and makes them very small." And plus, so you see, Rabbi Album, this man was on a level. That's what Reb Meir Simcha thought of him. Tell me, when did this come up in my teachings over the last 49 in Israel, 10 in America? When did this come up? Because I had a Rebbe, Reb Noach Bornstein. Do you remember him, Charlie, from the yeshiva in your time? The name? The name you remember. Do you remember him?
Sure, I had him.
Oh, so you know who I'm talking about. Reb Noach Bornstein. When I started getting involved in research on Europe and yeshiva, I have a world of material. That's why when the car knocked me down, I said to the Ribbono Shel Olam, "I have a lot more to teach." I was arrogant. I should have said, "I have a lot more to learn, but I do have a lot more to teach. Let me live." So I did my Reb Noach Bornstein was the greatest Diluy in the yeshiva world. When he went to, in 1931, he won $50 in 1 year. He did Yevamot, Ktuvot, and the three Bavas. No, I'd like to see Rakefet do it in 1 year. Okay? I'd love Zev. I'd love to see even your great grandfather do it in 1 year. Your grandfather, one of the Yad Chazakah, he probably could. Let's not put down the Yad Chazakah. His grandfather, one of the 14 students that the Altav Slabatka sent the Slutz to open the Slutz yeshiva. That yeshiva, you know where it is today? That's Lakewood. Slutz went to Kletsk and Kletsk went to Lakewood. That's the yeshiva. Plain and simple. So, you know what happened? A rabbinic delegation, RCA, visits Israel. I heard this from Rabbi Zeb Siegel. Rabbi Zev Siegel, Rabbi David Hollander, Gedolim Shabaretz, and they go to see the Briska Rav. And the Briska Rav says to them, "Mechenish avot from my Reb Noach. What happened to him? I don't hear a word about Reb Noach Bornstein. It's my best Talmud, the Briska Rav. Reb Velvel is saying this." And he lets, he says, "I am America." He says, "Your America takes idiots and nobodies and makes them great, and takes great people and turns them into nobodies." That's a vote from a velvet. And by the way, you don't have to believe me. I heard it with my own ears. It's written in one of the books on Rav Velvelein. Take a look in Melech's by Muller, whatever the name is, the biographies of Rav Velvel. There it is on Reb Noach Bornstein.
Does Rav Velvel have any contact at all with the book?
Yeah, what are you talking about? The Rav gave that Hesped on Rav Velvel? Rav Velvel had contact with the Rav. The Rav raised money for him. I gave money to... when they were in America, how much contact could they have? But in Europe, they had a lot. They had quite a bit of contact. The Rav
went off the derech.
Don't say that the Rav went off the derech. But with the Briska family, blood is thicker than mud. Okay? We'll put it that way. Now, finally, a year later, the war broke out in 1914. In 1915, Reb Lazer got back to America. How did he get back? He got a passport of someone his age. Those passports then did not have pictures, it had descriptions. And with that passport, he showed that he was invited to, I believe it was Norway, to be the chazan for Yomim Noraim. And he got to Norway, and from Norway, he got to New York. Yeah. Once on neutral soil, Silva readily made his way back to the United States. Now, here too, there's an interesting story. Where do you come to the United States? I can still remember Reb David telling me the story. Come into New York. You're either going to come San Francisco or New York, but from Europe you're going to come into New York. Comes into New York and right away goes to the home of Reb Shalom Yaffe, and they want to tell the family, but they don't want to shock the family. So Reb Yaffe says, we'll send a telegram to the president of the congregation in Harrisburg and ask him to go tell the Rebbetzin. Vic, the telegram arrives in Harrisburg, and the father is in business, a president. The president of a shul has to make a living. And the kids open the telegram. The kids get all excited. Teenage kids open the telegram, read it. The rabbi is back, and they run to the Rebbetzin a few blocks away, and they're shouting and yelling, Rebbetzin, Rebbetzin, the Rav is home, the Rav is back, the Rav is alive. She faints. The neighbors come, they revive her, they then read the telegram. I'm describing what Reb David, it's all in the Silva era, but I heard the story time and again. And the telegram said to call Reb Yaffe with his phone number. Knew who had telephones then? So I still remember this. We used to go to the drugstore to use a telephone. So they walked two blocks away to the store that had a telephone, and they used the telephone to call Reb Yaffe, and Reb Lazer Silva is back. By 1917, he starts to become an international, a national personality, and as you all know, ultimately an international personality. Now, he is the last of the Mohegans. What do I mean by that? Professor Chaim Waxman just came out with a new book on the swing to the right of orthodoxy in the United States. Very fascinating volume. I'm just about finished and with it, and I have a few comments that I want to make to him. Highly recommended. Fascinating. If you're interested, it's like Malka says, what did you learn? Facts. I said, no, I didn't learn facts, but the sociological analysis is right on. And it's Littman Publishers. Go online, you'll get it in a minute. Littman in England. And it's the swing to the right of orthodoxy. My dear students, may I quote the Rav to you? The Rav is talking to Rabbi Beryl Rosenzweig. And he says to Rabbi Rosenzweig, I quote this in my work on the Rav, who were your heroes when growing up? And the Rav doesn't wait for Beryl to answer, says, I'll tell you who your heroes were. Rabbis Lukstein, Goldstein, Young. Who are your son's heroes? The Rosh Yeshiva. And you all know that today. Practicing rabbis, they're second rate. Every kid getting married wants his Rosh Yeshiva to be Masada Kedushin at the wedding. Are you davening in a shul for 22 years, 23 years? You have a rabbi? No, the rabbi will give him to read the ketubah. Give him the first two brachot. But the Rashi Yeshiva ruled the world today, right or wrong. Look at the Mishpacha magazine. Look at the Ami magazine. Who did I quote? Who did I talk about? The Rashi Yeshiva. Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Moshe Feinstein. The Rav is Manenu. All right, the Hasidim have their Rebbeim. Rav Lezer Silva was the last rabbi, not a Rosh Yeshiva. Didn't have endless students. Had a few who he taught in Cincinnati, like Rav Chaim Moser taught and the Brisker Rav taught. It wasn't formal yeshiva, a few who gathered around him. But he became world class, national and then international. No one budged without Reb Lezer Silva. And you see, even in 1956, and there's no doubt in my mind, my chapter on post-World War II orthodoxy and Silva era is a overture to everything that's been written afterwards, including Professor Waxman. And that chapter, everyone read, and I got a lot of comments on it. But you see in 56, when they come out with the Cheirim against mixed board of rabbis, synagogue, council, right or wrong, 11 Rosh Yeshiva sign. Two signatures were missing. One was the Rav. He refused to sign. All right, we've spoken about it many times. I wanted to give a talk in America, by the way, on the Rav's position vis-a-vis synagogue council. And the YU people told me that the audience would not understand me. They're not sophisticated enough. I'm talking in a very prominent shul, but they felt 56 is ancient history. They won't comprehend fully what I'm saying. So I switched it to a different topic. Who is the other one who refused to sign? Reb Lezer Silva. But the fact that they asked him shows you the esteem that he was held. 12 Rosh Yeshiva were asked to sign and one practicing rabbi. Why did he refuse to sign? Yitzchak, do you know why? I alluded to it before. I'll quote Reb Lezer, Zevilin Noshtachin Yeshiva Sibschochalim. He was worried that this document, this cherem, would harm Yeshiva University. See, he lived in two worlds. He made the statement, Agudas Yisrael is mein ältere Schwester und Mizrachi is my jüngste Schwester. Agudas Yisrael is my elder sister, my oldest sister, and Mizrachi is my youngest sister. No? I'd like to hear Rav Aaron Cutler make that statement. I'd like to hear today Rav Aaron Feldman make that statement. I'd like to hear Rabbi Yitzvei make that statement. Zichrono Livracha. Like to hear the Nova Minska make that statement. Wouldn't go today. But this was Reb Lezer. This was exactly Reb Lezer. After World War I, he became a public figure. You have to understand the person in life has to make certain decisions. You can learn all your life. People go on learning. I'd like some of them to give a bechina, see what they know. But you can learn all your life. That sometimes you have to make a decision. I have to step into the public arena. I imagine what he saw in Europe, what was happening in World War I, and the Jews suffering, and Zionism in Palestine, and all that was happening with the Jewish people, the great turmoil engendered by World War I, made him decide to go public. And 1917, he's elected treasurer of the Agudas HaRabbanim. If you recall, and Yitzhak was referring to this before, I mentioned him in context, where he gets up at the convention right after he becomes treasurer, and all the Agudas HaRabbanim people are talking, we got to do this, we got to do that. And he gets up, he says, remember I quoted to you, I couldn't believe they published it. As, you're a bunch of phonies, mimnishkatan garnished. From all our resolutions of a year ago, we did nothing. And this was replaced, a man of action. From 1923 on, he was either president of the Egudas Rabbanim or a member of the Presidium. Only for a very brief period, there was a revolution when Rav Yosef Kanvich of Newark, and it was of Newark, was elected president in the mid-30s. It's a very brief two-year period where Rav Blazer was forced out. And that politics, leaving out all the human element, there was a L'shem Shemayim in it. Rav Yosef Kanvich was, first of all, do you know who he was? He was the Ridbaz's son-in-law, Rav Yosef Kanvich. He had a son who became very famous, president of a professor at Cornell, Professor Milton Kanvich, who was still a Shema Torah mitzvah. Later on, I don't know what's left in that family, that branch of the Ridbaz's family, but Rabbi Yosef Kanvich was a great Mizrahiite. And they were furious that the Aguda was starting to take hold in America, that people would speak Aguda ideology against Zionism, etc. And they fought to take over the Agudas Rabbanim. And for a brief period, they had the upper hand, but only for a very brief period. In 1925, Reb Blazer leaves Harrisburg. It was a small shtela. And he goes to a much bigger community, Springfield, Massachusetts. Springfield first. 1931, it's interesting, he's invited to Cincinnati. There's Machlaikis there. They want him to head up a base then, reach a decision. And they fall in love with him in Cincinnati. And he leaves Springfield to go to Cincinnati, where he remains the rest of his life. I have a feeling, and I don't want to play the role of a psychologist here, but there was an additional attraction to going to Cincinnati. If you know Reb Blazer's personality, what's Cincinnati famous for? The home of Reform Judaism. And nothing attracted him more than going into their backyard and accomplishing for Yiddishkeit. You want the proof? One of his first innovations when he came to Cincinnati is the old mikveh was in a bad area, changing areas. We all know the story. He built a new mikveh in the most beautiful area of Cincinnati. The Reform went crazy. They went to court, and he got Senator, the man who would later become Senator Taft, the son of the president, one of the most widely respected jurists, one of the most widely respected people altogether in the greater Cincinnati area, to represent the mikveh. And the Reform Jews, I'm told, when they saw who's representing and arguing the case, they understood already they have lost. And what's fascinating, and I tell the story in the Suva era, Reb Blazer wrote out in English about 20 different reasons why Jews need a mikveh. And he explains Erev Shabbos and Erev Yontiv and Kalim. And the last item he writes, Lahatir Isha Labala, that he should be able to resume relations with her. And Senator Taft looks and says, I think that this last reason is the most important. So you see, this was Reb Blazer. Who would ever dream what would come out of Cincinnati? I mean, it's amazing, the world that the president of Hebrew Union College is killed in a plane crash where he's the pilot flying a plane Shabbos morning when a few million Jews are in shul davening, a Shabbistic davening, and hearing Kriyat HaTorah. It's hard to believe. It's hard to believe what goes on in this region. You know what I'm talking about or not? 2 weeks ago. It's not ancient history. And I think that was part of Reb Leizer. All right, let me just go another 2 steps in describing his personality, and then I want to go in and start the facts on the ground. He was a character par excellence. As I mentioned before, Reb David Silva was a princely individual. He was a good chaver of Rabbi Emanuel Rachman. They got smicha together, learned in the yeshiva together. They were both made out of the same cloth of finekite, fineness. Wonderful people. Reb Leizer was a volcano and totally selfless. Ultimately, in Cincinnati, they had to give his salary to his wife, his second wife. His first wife died young. His second wife, she had been president, I believe, of the ladies' auxiliary, and she was a very elegant lady and took very good care of him. And you all know the legendary stories, which are true. He didn't eat in anyone's home. And whenever he traveled, she packed food for him and wrapped it in cellophane and would mark it for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. When he came to Israel, he ate in the Brisker Rav. See, that much he understood. When you go into the Brisker Rav, you don't play shtick like that. But in homes in America, including great Rabbanim who shall remain nameless, he did not eat. He came in with the packed food. Yitzchak understands my reference. All right, this was Reb Leizer. Character par excellence. Did I know him? Twice I had the privilege of seeing him and hearing him. And both times I got the feeling, wow, this man is different, unique. Once was a very simple story. 1961, at the age of 23, about as had to winter the great rabbinate as a Chinaman is to come into my shir and understand all my references in Yiddish and Hebrew, let alone English. So I go into the rabbinate. All right, I knew a little bit. I had smicha. I knew a little how to learn. I had 2 master degrees. Big deal. And here's my introduction. Lower Marion Synagogue, suburb of Philadelphia. Okay. Chalamed Sukkos, I get a phone call, 1961. Not a phone call, I'm listening to the radio. Phone call comes afterwards. And suddenly they interrupt the broadcast. The chief rabbi of Philadelphia has died. I understand 3 other rabbis alive almost had heart failure because there were 4 contenders for the throne of who was the chief rabbi. The one who died was Reb Eliezer Pupko, the Valeisha Rav. You've heard the name Pupko. There are many descendants, including students of mine in this very kollel. So the Valeisha Rav died, and a few weeks later, I get a call from a member of his family. I have a heksha for you, a bakery. I look into it, the bakery's Machal of Shabbos. I called the Rav. The Rav said, look, you give a heksha to a bakery that Machal of Shabbos. All you could do is maybe check ingredients and see if they separate parav and milchiks, but it's not something you can give a formal heksha on. So I call back the rabbi and I tell him it's Nishvamir. So he was Rotkov, you built nicht sein Reich. What's with you, Rabbi Rotkov? You don't want to be rich? So I say to him, so Abe says, nicht gut feich, for was is good for why? If it's not good for you, why do you want me? Why isn't it good for you? So he says, look, they may consider me a candidate to enter the Schlachthaus in place of the Valeisha Rav. I don't want them, my enemies, to say I give a heksha to a bakery that's Machal Shabbos. Anyway, a machloket went on. Who will succeed the Valeisha Rav in the Schlachthaus? And they finally agree. Only one man can make the decision. Reb Leizer Silva of Cincinnati. And here he is coming in, and we all go to 30th Street in Philadelphia to meet the train coming in from Ohio to meet Reb Lazer. And there's this little guy with a high hat, and everyone gathers around him. And I hear the, you know, I was a kid, but I hear the Elder Rabbanim saying to him, Rab Silva, come by me in Stubb, Chatzimah, have a separate room for you. And this one says, Chatzimah. And Reb Lazer says, where is the nearest hotel to where I have to be? I cannot go to anyone's house. It will be Sheikhad. And if ich nen Sheikhad, kann ich nicht sein, adayen, und machen a hachlata, and make a decision. Could you imagine, Reb Lazer? Boy, was I impressed. A few years later, Ani Rothkopf is now a Rav building from scratch the first Orthodox shul in Maplewood, South Orange. Now I'm prepared. What I went through in my first year in Lower Merion prepared me for the future. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam she'hakol nehiyeh bedvaro. It prepared me for the future. So, as you know, Rabbi Belkin said to me that ich mach bei chatnai, I'm making a condition, ich bin ach mamana Rosh Hashiva, I'm making a Rosh Hashiva, we're drinking a lechayim, but you have to remain in the rabbinate. So he picks up a phone to Vic Geller, and he says to Vic, get a shtela for Rabbi Rothkopf within commuting distance. And so Maple was beginning, they needed a rabbi, I was the first rabbi, and that's how it began. Fine. So now I'm in YU, a Rosh Yeshiva. Lumshi Yeshiva, it had to be 65, I would say, 64. Lumshi Yeshiva is making a dinner to raise money. Lumshi Yeshiva in Petach Tikva. You understand, the Lumshi Yeshiva went to Petach Tikva. It was a very important Litvish Yeshiva here, which over the years lost out to Panovich and the Chevron. But at one point it was a feeder school for Panovich, actually. The first Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Shmuel Rezovsky, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, was from Lumshi Petach Tikva. That's where he came when he came from Europe. So they're making a dinner, and who are they going to honor? Mr. Norman B. Abrams. No, Rabbi Zev Goldberg and Rabbi Yitz Rubin, do you fellas remember Mr. Abrams? No, now, the Jap, we used to call him, correct. NBA. But he ran a good operation. There was no shtick with him. I was once suspended indefinitely for 2 days because I went to my grandmother's funeral and I didn't have a note or permission. Oh, was he a character? All right. But then I worked for him. He was very nice to me. I can't say a bad word. So why are they honoring Norman B. Abrams? Let me give you some knowledge. What was Mr. Abrams' real name? Pachta. He was the son of Rab Avram Pachta, the Mashgiach of the Lumshi Yeshiva in Lumsha. He changed his name in America. When he came to America, people laughed at the name Pachta, Pechta, Shmechta. Changed it in honor of his father, Abraham, to Abrams. Beautiful. Norman B. Abrams. Honoring him was very smart. Because here you have someone who's tied to Lumsha and yet is part of the modern world. YU, Yeshiva University. Who were the two main speakers? Oh, this was an event thought out. You want the new and you want the old. You want the frummies and you want the enlightened. The two main speakers, Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Rachman and Reb Lazer Silva. If my memory is correct, the affair was at Riverside Plaza. I'm pretty sure it was Riverside Plaza. Okay, if my memory's correct, and I think it is. I got married then, I believe that this dinner was in Riverside Plaza. All right, all the Rosh Yeshiva are invited, we're guests of the Yeshiva, to give kavod to Mr. Abrams. All right, who didn't know Rabbi Rachman? We all knew Rabbi Rachman, the famous rabbi, Dr. Emanuel Rachman. He's the first speaker. Well, what language did he speak? English, obviously. Now the high point, Reb Lazer Silver, the Cincinnati Rav, a member from the Presidium, from the Agudas Harabonim. Reb Lazer gets up, I'm repeating it word by word. If the son of my good friend, Harav David Rachman, can speak in English, I will also speak in English. And he gave up, and he gave up people. You should have heard that man. But when he reached the crescendo, 20 minutes later, the high point, he broke into Yiddish. He couldn't carry out the whole people in English. See, the Yiddish. I'm living in Israel 49 years, so I have to admit I can speak in Hebrew and cry in Hebrew and laugh in Hebrew. Perhaps not on the level I do in English, but not that far below. But Reb Lazer, not the Rav. The Rav could carry out in English and end off in English and speak of Psalms and Job and Deuteronomy and Exodus, right or wrong, Genesis. You go out of your mind, Rebbe, say Bereshit. No, when he was talking. Unbelievable, unbelievable. But Reb Lazer, ultimately, he broke. You know why I saw that again? Reb Eliezer Menachem Manshach, the Panovich Rosh Yeshiva. Charlie, you have to remember this. The night of the dirty deal, when they had to decide whether to go with the Avoda. Remember, there was a whole deal worked out in there with Peres, Shimon Peres. And he gave that famous talk at Yad Eliyahu. I don't think the stadium is standing anymore. He was sitting there with his... No, they renamed it, they fixed it, or whatever. Yeah, all right, Baruch Hashem. And I'll never forget the Belzer Rebbe was sitting next to Rav Avadjah Yosef, and whenever anyone said a word or two in Yiddish, the Belzer Rebbe leaned over and explained it to Rav Avadjah in Hebrew. It was a sight, it was a moment in time. I'm not an agudist, but I love Gedolei Yisrael, what can I tell you? And I'll never forget, Rav Shach gets up to speak. That was the famous speech about the kibbutzim and the rabbits. Remember, there had just been an item in the newspaper, the Shvanim, that in the kibbutz, they were eating rabbits. And Rav Shach, and then he started to speak about the home in Europe and what it was like. And if you recall, he broke down in tears and he switched to Yiddish. He couldn't say it in Hebrew anymore. I remember he's living here many years. No, he couldn't go further in Hebrew. He broke down and he breaks into Yiddish. And I remember on the radio, the TV, they got people who knew Yiddish to translate as he's speaking. But I can understand Reb Lazer. But one thing I can tell you, he was a character par excellence. And this was the story I've told you many times. I heard from the Rav when, if you recall, I'll repeat it just to put context. When the Rav is going to give his first talk before the Agudas Harabanim, remember the Yitzchak?
Yes.
You look upset. Don't be upset, people. Yeah, no, you heard it, so you'll hear it again. It's 2 minutes, but people have to hear it in context. The Rav told Reb Yosef Dov, told his son, not the Rav, Reb Moshe told his son, when you walk into the room, hot nisht meira, don't get upset, don't get frightened, say, kuk anois fi shein rabbonim. He says, that's where he made the comment to the Rav. They haven't opened the book since they got to America. They have a good memory. But Sister Aina, there's one. He'll be sitting in the corner, a kleiner, a short guy with a high hat. He knows how to learn. And you all know, after the shiur, he shook hands with the Rav, slipped him a paper with 6 or 7 good questions, the Rav said. And Rav David Silver quoted his father, why did he wear a high hat? Because he was a man of principle. And a high hat, a hard high hat, a cylinder, you can't crease, you can't bend, you can't fold. And that was Reb Lazer Silver. So I want to reiterate, then I want to speak in Yana Dioma. So what do we do today? We set the stage. We're going to go in, we're going to do material, reveal secrets that I never wanted to reveal, but at my age and at this moment in history already, the secrets can be revealed. You should see what people went through and what we struggled on the American scene. But you have a bit of a background who Reb Lazer was. The truth of the matter is that he has many descendants who are B'nai Terah. Not all, unfortunately, not all. I met from part of the families with the same names, Balei Tshuva, coming back after 2 generations already where there was no real commitment to Torah. But he has many descendants, Le'ela Le'ela. On Reb David's side, everyone is Shomer Torah Mitzvah until today. And some of you know that Reb David's son, Reb Baron Silver, is a very well-known Rosh Yeshiva in Kerem Biafna. That's Reb Baron Silver. It's Reb David's son, Reb Lazer's grandson, married to my student, Shoshana Freudenstein. That's one example. There are other wonderful children in the family. And he was Zeicher, came at a difficult time, but was Zeicher, and most of the children live al Atmat HaKodesh, his descendants from the Silver family, from the Gershuni family, Huzacha. But that was Reb Lazer. The next step with Reb Lazer is to go into the Kashrut problems he dealt with. Till now, we've spoken in general terms. We spoke about New York, but you'll see what happens across the board, the United States. And that's the first aspect of his life I want to touch. And then we'll go further into new areas, leave Kashrut behind. My dear students, today is a very emotional day for us. And I want to say a vort that is perfect for today. I had a very revered neighbor for many decades, till death do we part. Unfortunately, death is part of life and it catches up with us. My neighbor was Reb Yehoshua Huttner, the first cousin to Reb Yitzchak Huttner. Reb Yehoshua Huttner, whose sister was married to Reb Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Reb Yehoshua Huttner, who was the right hand of Reb Meir Bar Ilan, Reb Meir Berlin, Reb Yehoshua Huttner, who we owe the Encyclopedia Talmudica to. He was the man, he was the genius behind it. He was the person on the ground, worked hand in hand with Reb Shlomo Yosef Zevin and all the other giants who brought the encyclopedia to reality. He was married by Zivik Sheni and her Zivik Sheni to a lady I know since 1951. One of the greatest ladies I ever knew, Batsheva Ziv Soloveitchik Huttner, the widow of Rav Shmuel Soloveitchik, who married Rav Yehoshua Huttner Bezivik Sheni, Isha Gedola. Rav Huttner said at her funeral, I never met a greater lady than Rebbetzin Batsheva, who I was privileged to be married to, Bezivik Sheni. So it was the Yom Kippur War. The Yom Kippur War was very difficult, very shocking. We came in Aliyah 69, everyone walked around 7 foot tall, indefeatable Israel. And we all know Yom Kippur War, the price we paid, thousands upon thousands dead. I was in Israel 4 years already. You don't know how many people I knew who died in the Yom Kippur War, including right from this institution, what BMT, etc. But that was the war. We're sitting Chol HaMoed and Rabbi Huttner's sukkah, and no one knows what will be. and Rabbi Yoshua the following to me. He said, we say in Hallel, Ana Hashem Hoshiana, Ana Hashem Hatzlichana. What does this mean? If we have Yeshua, was Tachman Hoban Hatzlacha? Ana Hashem Hoshiana Gnug. But we say it, and then switch. Hatzlichana. And I think he was saying it over from Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Said there's a big difference. That God will save us, we have a promise. There will be no Churban Shlishi. We're going to be saved in this war. But then the question is, will that salvation last? We need Hatzlacha, that the Yeshua should be permanent. And every time we have a Yeshua, the world interferes with us. And he spoke about the Sinai campaign. We conquered, we went, and we had to give everything back. And here you had the Six-Day War, you had the Yeshua, and take a look, here we have the Yom Kippur War. And Rav Futner said, for sure, the Yom Kippur War, God will save us, we will win. But will it last? Will it have permanence? Or will the nations of the world once again knife us in the back? I want to tell you, yesterday was a great day. Yom Yerushalayim. That was a kiyum of Ana Hashem Hoshiana. Today is even a greater day, because what Donald Trump, Cyrus III, Melech Koresh, Truman called himself Cyrus II, Cyrus III. He's making it Hatzlacha, making it permanent. Until now, we only had Yeshua. We didn't have Hatzlacha. Now we have Hatzlacha. It's a great day. Today, Mamash, if we said Hallel yesterday, I think the Chi of today is even greater. And I want to throw out an idea to anyone listening who has contact with Bnei Akiva in Israel. I'm sort of out of the loop because I'm here in extraterritorial status, American territory, we speak English. I don't have contact. Anyone can talk to Rav Chaim Drukman in my name. He knows me. Or to someone else of influence, Bnei Akiva should undertake a project that every day of the year, including Yom Kippur, there should be a demonstration outside the German embassy in Tel Aviv demanding that the Germans move their embassy to Jerusalem. To put it mildly, they have a sacred, moral, ethical obligation to the Jewish people, to Jerusalem, to our continuity, to our Hatzlacha. And I have a number of freebies here, but do we have a chazan here? Yomo, back in. Lead us. Yerushalayim Yecha. Let me hear it. No? Go ahead. Here's an interesting little volume right up to date. Kedushat Batei Knesset or Batei Medrashot. It's about treating a synagogue properly, not talking during davening. What's beautiful about this little pamphlet, all the Musar and the stories are basically from Israel, from people we know, from the Baba Sali, from Rabbanim, contemporary, not before our time. Yitzchak, this is for you, Rav Asher, Asher Weiss. Just amazing, the questions. Here he deals with which is more important, study of Torah or ma'asim tovim. Here he deals with another question. You're walking down the street in Borough Park and you see a store, a grocery, and you want to get yourself some cookies and a drink, but across the street is a Goyish supermarket, ShopRite. And it's cheaper there. Where do you buy? Do you buy at the Jew or do you buy at the ShopRite? Here is a magazine I can barely lift. This is an old, it's a year or a year and a half ago. Let me see the date. It's Tishrei, no. It's less than, it's Tishrei Tashrei. It's October 2nd, 2017. This is Mishpacha, the Israeli edition. I have never seen a more beautiful magazine in my life. It has articles on Litvish Gedolim, on Chassidish Gedolim, on Sfadish Gedolim. It has articles here on the famous Jewish streets across the world, including Geula, including 13th Avenue and Borough Park that we were just talking about. What a beautiful magazine. And it doesn't have one picture of a woman. But they tell me something is happening. They say on the website now they are showing pictures of women. So you see, their attitude is, if you're such a rusher that you have a computer, that you look at a website, go look at pictures of women. Do Grace Eisfaf. You follow? Okay, 1 second. Now, this is very interesting. I think it's Machon HaMikdash has issued coins with Cyrus III, President Trump, on the coins. I think that is beautiful. I hope they gave a set of the coins to President Trump. Ah, beautiful. A great Jew, I should have spoken, Rabbi Shalom Dovber Gutnik, died last week. He was the first Lubavitch Rav in Australia, sent by the sixth Rebbe. And he and Itzhak David Grona put Chabad on the map and saved tens of thousands of Australians became Shomrei Shabbos. His son is the famous Yossel Gutnik, if you recall that name. Here's a very fascinating story about a secretary in a legal office, a Jewish woman, Sylvia Bloom, and she worked for the same law firm for 67 years until she retired at age 96 and died not long afterwards. And this lady, that no one knew who she was, what she was, she dies with more than $9 million. And the money is going to charity. I'd love to see that some Torah institutions gain. How did she make the money? She was the secretary in the legal office. She handled the correspondence for the lawyers and saw what they invested in. And on that basis, she invested the little money she had. And as they say, the rest is history. Gentlemen, baseball ain't what it used to be. And I want to file a protest. Money speaks today. Your Rakefet walks. Do you know that they announced that the Yankees and Red Sox are going to be playing 2 games in London next year? And we'll organize a plane going from here. All the stupid Americans. London is a... Hey, Charlie, it'll take us 3 hours. We'll see the Yankees.
But I want you to know the Red Sox have a higher payroll
than the Yankees. Wow.
The Red Sox have the highest payroll in baseball, and the Yankees are substantially reduced.
Right, they cut back once Rodriguez, etc. Well, Yitz is very proud. He's from Boston. This is a beautiful article on Americans who contributed to the great efforts in 47 and 48. I don't have to tell you what went on, what we did. I was walking home from Solanta one day, had a 5-block walk to my house, and on Park Avenue, police cars and FBI guys, and we found out, it was in all the newspapers, the next day they were arresting, it was a paper plant where they printed and stationery, and they were sending arms wrapped in the newspaper, wrapped in the stationery to Israel. And the FBI, there was an embargo. I don't think anyone went to jail finally, but it was quite bad. This is very interesting. Tyson Foods invests 2 million Israel startup developing lab-grown meat. There's a way now, they're making meat, and it begins with tissue culture, and the same shayla, is it parav or is it fleshiks? And if you follow Rav Chaim Moysa, it is parav. So you can have now that you'll be able to manufacture meat, parav. Unbelievable what's going on. What? It's unbelievable. It takes us back to what I spoke about in class, the Balabatish Seichel and the Lumdish. Here is in America, it isn't kosher to borrow from Quicken Loans. It seems this is a loan facility that's owned by Jews, and they didn't have a heter iska, or a proper heter iska. Believe me, they're getting one now. And the last two, conservative congregations tweak services in an effort to reinvent the movement. Well, you can read what they're trying to do. You can blow your brains out. Any relationship between that and Yiddishkeit is purely coincidental. And they have a new expression. You can be a Jew and be a JFK. You know what a JFK is? Just for Kiddush. At least come just for Kiddush. Sounds like Chabad. And finally, the New York Times, president of Jewish seminary killed in plane crash in Hudson Valley. Rabbi Aaron D. Pankin. It's unbelievable. Shabbos morning, and no one says boo.
I don't want to show my students.
Until we meet again in health and happiness, a happy Yom HaShagri. Good today. Das Vedanya.